Welcome to The Yarn, a School Library Journal production. I'm Travis Yonker. It was an honor to talk with the great Lane Smith about his latest picture book, Stickler Loves the World. Also in this episode, Lane and I discuss how he got started in children's literature, how he balances irreverence with sweetness in his work, and his thoughts on posthumously published books. Here's my conversation with Lane Smith. Lane Smith, so great to be talking to you. We're going to be talking about Stickler Loves the World today. And my first question is just, how are you describing the book to people?
Well, I guess I haven't had to describe it to anyone yet. One of the reviews said it was a buoyant ode to joy. I think that's a pretty good definition. It's really, I guess it's a book about just noticing things in the world. And sometimes we forget, but through this irrepressible character who lives in a strange part of the woods, so you assume he's some sort of monster, but he's actually this lovable guy, wears his heart on his sleeve. He points out all the little things, and that it came to me because that's what I do here in the woods when I go on my morning walks, and usually my dog and cat follow me, and we have about 13 acres, so they can't escape. And I just talk out loud. I can't help it, but I'll say to the cat, you know, Lulu, oh my goodness, have you seen this? Look at this, the veins on this leaf. It's crazy. It's like a little map. You know, and then we'll walk a little further and Jojo will topple over my little Shih Tzu. And I'll say, Jojo, look at that rock you're resting on. Look at the textures on that. It's amazing. And I guess I just notice that stuff anyway as a visual person. But because they're with me, for some reason, I say it out loud that if the neighbors ever saw me, you know, they think I was crazy. But when I wanted to do a Stickler book, I was trying to decide on its personality, and that it just seemed appropriate that Stickler would be this wide-eyed enthusiast because he has so many eyes.
So how did it, so it was on one of the walks when it sort of, you got the inspiration. When did the switch flip where you said, hey, this could be a book?
Well, it began with the book I did before that, A Gift for Nana. Yeah. And the rabbit goes on a quest and encounters different folks along the way who have gift suggestions to the rabbit. So, you know, a big fish and the moon. And as the journey gets more surreal, and Stickler enters woods that are dark and kind of weird, it seemed logical that whoever lived there would also be weird looking. So, you know, Rabbit meets this strange Stickler guy, and he offers Rabbit a stick, of course. And then that was it. It just appeared on one page. But I thought, after I finished the book, I couldn't really get that guy out of my mind. I liked the way it looked. It kind of reminded me of some of my older books. And I just wanted to inhabit Stickler's world a little more. So the two came together where I wanted to do a book with a Stickler and then these walks with my dog and cat and this, you know, shameless enthusiast. It just meshed. And it was fun. And I don't know about you, but for me, that's always the favorite part is just making the book. Hammering out the details and rewriting all that in the dummy is a little, you know, tiresome. But when you finally get all the kinks and you just sit down to make the finishes, that's when I'm the happiest. And, you know, unlike you being in front of kids and people all the time. I'm very reclusive, and I just don't know how to act around people. So I just love to have this job where I could sit in this beautiful old barn I have, surrounded by every book I've ever owned and all my art supplies and all these strange objects, and to just create a book. And then the book comes out, and you know, then it's kind of scary because then the reviews come out and all that. But the favorite part is just making the book.
So when you say making the book, you mean like once the story is set, you know what it's going to look like, and actually sitting down and making kind of like the final artwork for it?
Yeah. And, you know, it changes as you go. Sometimes you'll tweak a line at the last minute. And, but yeah, that's when I'm just happiest. I mean, what a blessed life to get to sit all day long and draw characters and enter these other worlds. It's just, I never could have imagined when I was in high school art class that someday I would get to do this for a living.
When did you first think about children's books as being kind of an avenue for you?
Well, no one in my family had ever gone to college. And so it was just not an issue. And in fact, we didn't have books growing up. I would go to the library, and my parents thought I was a little weird. You know, well, what's this guy doing reading? And in my high school art class, Mr. Boffman at Corona High School in California, and he pulled me aside one day and just said, you know, people do this for a living. They you can make a living drawing pictures. And I thought maybe he meant that the, you know, drawing caricatures at the pier with the big heads and the little body. And so he personally drove me to Pasadena to Art Center College and got me an appointment with the counselor. And I showed her my portfolio, and she said, you know, you just keep working on it. And so I took night classes and life drawing classes, and eventually I got accepted. And then when I was there, that's when I discovered kids' book. Because as a kid, I'll be 64 this month. And, you know, there weren't that many kids' books. There was Where the Wild Things Are and some things like that, but I didn't have access to them. The only thing I recall seeing, I had a lot of Big Little books, and we had Dr. Seuss books, and you know, comic books. But then when I was at Art Center, I would see all this great European stuff. You know, I would see books by Tommy Ungerer and you know, John Birmingham, and like, wow, this stuff is cool.
Yeah.
And so it just kind of lit a fuse. And that was one of the most prestigious art schools, but they didn't teach a course on children's books at the time. I was in the same class as Dave Shannon and Marla Frazee and Thomas Kincaid, the painter of light.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. And then later, of course, Marla Frazee became a teacher there. But at the time, they didn't teach a course. So then I had to drive every day from Orange County to Art Center. Then on weekends, I would drive to the other school, Parsons in Los Angeles, to take a course that Barbara Botner taught on children's books. So it was, I guess I really wanted to do it.
Yeah. I feel like that is such that time is such a period where a lot of folks who end up making picture books and illustrating, they kind of like first rediscover or discover children's books, you know, and they're like, oh my gosh, there's this whole world out here that I knew a little bit about, but you know, they make new discoveries and it really is an inspiring thing for them.
Yeah. Of course, nowadays they can go on Pinterest and just everything is at their fingertips, but
yeah.
I would go to tag sales or to used library sales, or always look in the budget bins at big book retailers, and all the best stuff was the stuff that was marked down, in my opinion. And yeah. Ralph Steadman did kids' books. Look at this. It's amazing. And, you know, so, and then my wife and I went to Europe, and I was just amazed. You know, I'd find these books in other languages that were just beautiful, that I had never even heard of the illustrators. And yeah, it was very, it was just so fun to, it was like a little treasure when you would, and even today still, I might find a book, or Bob will show me a book, or someone will show me a book, and I'm just blown away, you know, and I'll think, why haven't I ever heard of this? That's how it was when I moved to New York, and I went to, did you ever go to the Gotham Book Mart on 47th Street?
No.
It was the hangout of Edward Gorey, and he would just sit in the back and sign books, and you could go in there, and for $10, you could buy an Edward Gorey book signed by Edward Gorey. And one day I was in there and I discovered The Shrinking of Treehorn by Florence Perry Heidi. Yeah. And it just blew my mind. And I immediately came home and wrote her a letter. And then she and I were pen pals for 20 years, just writing back and forth. And eventually we got to do a book together. But yeah, it's just there's nothing like the thrill of discovering something you've never seen before.
So with Stickler, when you first were kind of, you had the idea for the book, how did the writing of that go? Or I guess, what's your process for that? I mean, do you sketch out the story first? Are you writing the text first? What's the first, like, where did you begin with that book?
I didn't want it to be as wordy as The Gift for Nana, so I was sort of intent on keeping the text a little leaner, so I had that in my mind.
Yeah.
And I think once I set it up and introduced the idea that, you know, Stickler says, you know, oh, to see the world is so, you know, weird and wonderful. Oh, to see it all anew. Wouldn't that be amazing? And then when he runs into a space alien who's never seen our planet, who actually turned out to be his friend Crow, with a pea, can of peas stuck on his head, and the three peas in a pod look like three eyes, green eyes, so he even looks more like an alien. And he even says, you and your cutting-edge space helmet, which I didn't realize until later, that's kind of a double meaning, because the can, you know, probably had a sharp edge. But once I had that set up, that he was going to show the world to this person who's new to our planet, then it was fun, because I thought, what do I want to paint? You know, I want to paint big rocks with big textures, and I want to, I want to do an ocean with curly waves. And so, you know, you get those things you want to put in there, and then you build a story around that, and then stuff, you know, gets cut and stuff gets added. And so, it was really fun. And sometimes I have a book that I'm starting next, and it was overwritten. I think I was reading a lot of William Steig, who's one of my favorites. And when I got it all done, I was like, wow, this is like 2,000 words. So I put it in a I showed it to the publisher first, and they rejected it and just said, it's in for us. But then I put it in a drawer, as I often do. And I have this thing I do these days where then without, I'm blessed with a terrible memory. So without rereading it, I think I'm just going to write it from memory. And so I write it, And so this new one I wrote, and I said, I'm just going to keep it to 3 or 4 words per page. And I wrote it, and it came out just clean and perfect.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, it's just like the first one. Then I pulled out the first one from the drawer, and oh, it's nothing like the first one. So that's another way I like to work sometimes.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'll talk with different authors and illustrators, and occasionally some folks will say that they do something along those lines where they try to do a draft where they don't look at any previous work, and then they try to do it from memory. That does seem like such a I don't know, it seems like you would find a new path for the story when you're working that way.
Yeah. Well, I thought I was being original.
So was there you said that the review mentioned joy for Stickler. Was that kind of the mood you were trying to capture, or was there a tone or mood that you had in mind?
I just wanted it to be, I like the contrast of this pointed, sort of dangerous, almost looking edged character contrasted with someone who's the sweetest guy, you know, sweetest guy in the world. Yeah. So I wanted it to be just, you know, and I probably wouldn't have done that 20, 30 years ago. I would have been trying to be a little more edgy, but it's true. When you get older, you just think, I don't care. I'm going to be sentimental, and I'm going to make, what's the matter with just making a joyful character that loves the world and loves his friends and loves the earth? And, and I've been lucky that people have said that, you know, this could be saccharine, but he kind of saves it. You know, he's not too sappy. And so I like that. And that's exactly what I went for Gift for Nana and this book. And then I have a couple other books I'm working on, and one of them's a little dark because it's monsters, but then the other one is completely, it's a classroom book and it's completely wacky, so I guess I like to mix it up.
Yeah, that's interesting, because you know, you do sort of like irreverent books so well, and then something that's a little bit more maybe sentimental or nostalgic, like you do that well as well. You know, it's like do you feel like you get to like share these different parts of your personality through your books?
Yeah, I do. We all grow and evolve. I saw an interview with David Byrne, and someone said, I only like your early stuff. What's this new stuff you're doing? And he said, well, you obviously don't like me if you don't want me to evolve and grow and try new things. And and that's, I think I would have been maybe a little more tentative 10 years. Everything I did and the stuff I did with John Cheska was just irreverent, you know? And, but when I think about one of my very first books, The Big Pets, which came out in, I think, 92.
Yeah.
91. I mean, that rereading that, I haven't read it for years, and I reread it, and I thought, wow, this is kind of like what I'm doing now. Yeah. And, you know, life just takes you on different paths, and you go with what, I guess, works for a while. But I think that is more my personality, to try to do sweet stuff, but it could have a sense of humor and a little bit of an edge too. And it's a hard balance to get, but I guess that's what I'm going for. And we mentioned William Steig earlier. Well, Steig does that really well. You know, he'll have you know, Sylvester and the Magic Pebble, man, you know, that just breaks my heart. Read it, and the parents are sitting on the rock, and Steig and Kate DiCamillo. I just bawl when I read their
Oh
books.
my gosh, yes. Yeah, Steig always does this thing, I feel like, where he takes the danger like one step farther than you're expecting it to go, or he takes like the despair one step farther than you think it's going to go. And yeah, it is. It's just like a heartbreaking thing. And man, he's so good.
And he was, he's another one that I think worked up until he was in his 90s, didn't he? He was
Yeah.
just, I mean, how great is that to just be able to do what you love? I read a quote with him once where he said, "I hate to illustrate, but I love to draw." And which is, so he just got to sit there and doodle all day long, which is great. But actually, I like the books that are a little more thought out and illustrated by him.
Yeah.
Things like Rotten Island, where he would actually put some paint
Yeah.
into them. But towards the end, he was still doing fantastic books, but he was just kind of, he didn't want to think about it. I don't think the drawings too much. But
Right.
he's great.
Yeah.
The Provensons, my other
Oh
favorite.
yeah.
Yeah, they're great.
There's this new book. I don't know if you saw this. It's like a there they had they created like a dummy of a book that was never released, that's getting released this fall. Did you see that?
Yeah, the one with the cat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just saw it reviewed in the Times. I think Leonard
Okay.
Marcus reviewed it. I'll buy
Yeah.
it. You're gonna probably, when I die, you'll see some of those. My wife will, some posthumous books my wife will publish. No, they rejected this one, but he did some finishes in here and a couple of doodle.
You mentioned your wife. I was wondering, like, who do you work closely with your books? I would imagine you work with her quite a bit. Do you have like a longtime editor? I don't know your situation with that. Like, are you showing your work to people in early stages, friends, or anything like that?
I work really close, very closely with Molly Leach, my wife, because sometimes the design will influence the amount of text or the way an illustration falls on a page. And
Yeah.
that is such a luxury because a lot of people will just turn their book in and maybe have suggestions where the type would go, but they pretty much take it and do their own thing. But she's designed all of my books since day one. So I do that. And then I've been doing this for, I don't know, over 35 years. So you'd think I would have a lot more people I could rely on, but really I've winnowed it down to, there's really like three or four people whose opinion I really respect, and I think we're thinking on the same page.
Yeah.
Definitely Bob Shea. He's so just giving, and I'll just say, he'll say, what, he'll text me, "What are you doing today?" And I'll say, "Oh, I'm trying to work on this new book about a witch. Send it to me. Can I see it?" And I said, "Well, give me a couple more days." And he's always open to seeing stuff.
Yeah.
And Lori Keller's suggestion for the Stickler was to have the little asides that the crow whose head is
Oh
stuck.
yeah.
The crow will kind of say dizzy, after he's off the boat. And I think of,
Yeah.
well, afterwards I realized, well, yeah, that's kind of like something Laurie would write. Always has a little Greek chorus of characters, commenting on the act or whatever. And Bob's like the kind of guy I like, who's a nuts and bolts guy. He'll just say, "This page doesn't make sense." And you probably find the same thing, where you lose your objectivity. You're just so into the story, And all of a sudden, someone points out, why would he do this suddenly? And think, oh, you're right. You know, and you just don't see it. So he's good like that. And then he's a little bit like Laurie, because he always has these fantastic punchlines. He'll say, well, he should say this, and it'll be like the best thing I've ever heard. But yeah. I think, I can't. That sounds like that's such a Bob Shea line. You know, I know it would crack up the kids and crack up the library, and the teachers, but I don't think it's right for this book. So, but he's very generous. Always has good ideas and suggestions. And then I look at his books too. I think it's lopsided. I think he gives me more creative feedback than I give to him. Yeah. But he's great. I love his books.
What's your hope for Stickler? Like, how do you approach it when a book of yours comes out in the world? You know, there's a wide range, I feel like, of authors and illustrators I've talked to. You know, some are sort of like, well, the book's done, there's nothing I can do about it. Some people, you know, they're more invested when it comes to how it's received. Where do you fall on that?
Kind of in the middle, because I'm not an outgoing person. So I'm not one to tour and read aloud and promote. And, but I also have an ego. So I want the book to do well, and I want people to see it, and I want people to like it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of in the middle, where I'll put it out into the world and hope people discover it. But you do have to get the word out. And, I like this, podcast, idea, because you could stay at home and it's like we're just having a nice conversation. It's great. It's not like, you know, I'm on the Today Show and just sweating it out, you know. Back in the day, I did all that stuff, you know. CBS Sunday Morning, the Today Show, and a lot of NPR, and I remember Sheska and I were on Roseanne Barr had a short-lived talk show. We were on that show.
Wow.
And John, you know John, he just loves it. He's just the most gregarious guy. He likes doing that more than making the book. I like making the book. He likes all the going out and promoting. Kind of, so we're sort of polar opposites.
The book's an excuse to talk to people.
Yeah.
Thank you, Lane, for the interview. Thank you, Caroline Sun, for making it happen. Thank you to my co-host, Colby Sharp. Thank you, Philip Stead, for creating our theme music. Additional music for this episode from the Free Music Archive. Have an idea for the show? You can contact us via email at theyarnpodcast@gmail.com and visit us online at the School Library Journal website. I'm Travis Yonker. Thanks for listening.